We're in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. I told you last week that this book, 2 Thessalonians, was written shortly after 1 Thessalonians, and its primary objective was for Paul to answer a problem that had, or a misunderstanding, I should say, that had arisen from his first epistle. The misunderstanding was that because he told them, you know, they should be watching for the Lord's coming and so forth, that his coming could be any moment now. From their perspective. And as we know, it's been almost 2,000 years and he hasn't come back yet. So obviously it wasn't imminent at that time. And the Apostle Paul tries to actually use the teaching of Jesus himself to show them that the coming of the Lord was still some time off. He didn't tell them how long, but he did tell them about certain things that had to occur first. Before they could start getting all excited that the coming of the Lord was imminent. So let's pick up in verse 1. He says, "Yet we plead with you, brothers, concerning the arrival of our Master Jesus Christ and our being collected together to him, not to be so quickly unsettled from understanding, nor to be alarmed, not by spirit, nor by message, nor by letter, as if by us, to the effect that the day of Christ has become imminent. None of you should succumb to anyone's deception through any method, because should not the apostasy come first, and the revealing of the man of sin, the son of destruction, the one opposing and self-exalting above every name God or worship thing, so also as a God to appoint himself in the temple of God, portraying himself that he is a God. Do not remember that when I was, while being with you, I told you these things?" I'm going to stop there for a moment, and we'll talk about these verses first. First thing I want to point out is that the Apostle Paul connects together the arrival of Jesus Christ and our being collected together to him in the first verse. Now, you may remember in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, he talked about the order of events surrounding Christ's coming with regard to the resurrection, right? He said that the dead in Christ, or Christ is going to return with a shout, the trumpet blast, the voice of the archangel, and then the dead in Christ will rise first. And then we who are alive and remain will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And from then on, we'll always be with the Lord, is what he says there. So he has already talked about us being gathered together to him. But in this particular chapter, the apostle constantly references back to what Jesus taught in Matthew 24. You may remember that when we went through chapter 5 of 1 Thessalonians, which followed immediately after what we just talked about, that the apostle was referencing several things from Luke chapter 21, where Jesus was talking about his second coming as well. Here in chapter 2 of 2 Thessalonians, he begins to reference what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 24, where he was also basically talking about the same things. So go to Matthew 24. Let's flip in our Bibles there. What we're going to do is we're going to compare some of the things that Paul said to what Jesus taught in that chapter. First of all, since we'll take it in the order that the Apostle Paul is mentioning things here, and when he talks about the arrival of our Master and our being collected together to him, this is spoken of by Jesus in Matthew 24, 29 through 31. So let's read that. "Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon shall not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven." That is when the sun is dark and the moon is blood red. "The sign will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds." Four winds means north, south, east, and west, by the way. "From one end of heaven to the other." So this particular passage, which the Apostle Paul is referencing here, actually tells us when this is going to take place. When did he say it's going to take place? Immediately after the tribulation, right? That's what he said. And he associates, Jesus associated his arrival with him sending the angels out to gather together all of his elect. And I want you to notice these are Jesus' elect. So these are Christians that are being gathered together by the angels immediately after the tribulation. And that, of course, corresponds with what Paul said in 1 Thessalonians 4 when he talked about the sound of the trumpet and the dead rising and us being caught up together in the air to meet the Lord in the air. Us being caught up together is by means of the angels. The angels are the ones that are going to actually physically pick us up and take us up off of the earth, off the surface of the earth, into the clouds. Now, he says in, flip back to Thessalonians, or my translation there. He says, we plead with you, brothers, concerning the arrival of our Master Jesus Christ and our being collected together to him, as though this is one single event, not to be so quickly unsettled from understanding, nor to be alarmed. Now, why would he say unsettled from understanding, which is literally what it means? Your understanding has been shaken or altered in some way. What he's talking about is the fact that he had already taught them the truth prior to this, but they were being, at this time, they were being shaken from what they were originally taught by the Apostle Paul. That's what he means. Nor to be alarmed. And this word alarmed, some people think, well, why would anybody be alarmed that the second coming is, you know, right around the corner? Why would they be alarmed by that? But the word alarmed doesn't mean a bad thing necessarily. It simply means to be overly excited. All right. In fact, Jesus used the very same word in Matthew chapter 24. Look at verse. Hang on. I thought I wrote it down, but I didn't. Just a second. Here it is, verse 6. When he's talking about some of the signs leading up to his coming, he says, you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled or alarmed. That's the same word, and it's talking about being overly excited. All right? So anyway, Paul says he's encouraging them or pleading with them not to be so quickly unsettled from their understanding, nor to be alarmed. And then he says, not by a spirit, nor by a message, nor by a letter, as if by us. Now, there were different manners in which people were coming or learning things. There were, at this time, in the church, there were some people who would speak in tongues or prophesy and things of that nature, right? We learned about that in 1 Corinthians 14. And sometimes people would get up and speak a message to the congregation that they were portraying as though this is a message from God, when in fact it's not a message from God. That happens. In fact, John says in 1 John chapter 4, beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits whether they are from God. So the idea was that there are people, even in the congregations, that will, you know, give out some kind of a message that is portrayed to be from God, but in fact it's not. And so the instructions to the believers is, hey, don't just take everything at face value, right? Check it out and make sure that this is truly what is true and what is being said by God. So that's what he means by not by a spirit or by a message. And then he says, nor by a letter as if by us. And one of the problems that was facing the Apostle Paul in the early years and actually became a huge problem a little bit later, we learned from some of the early church fathers, was that there were epistles or letters being sent to various churches in the name of an apostle that were forgeries. And the Apostle Paul was aware of that. In fact, Tertullian and some of the others actually wrote about that, about how much that even the epistles were being corrupted and false epistles were being made and were circulating, and it was becoming a problem. The Apostle Paul understood that it was a problem in his day, because there are imposters, there are people who infiltrate the church who want to undermine it. And so the Apostle Paul developed a little scheme of authenticating his letters. Does anybody remember what that was? Does anybody know what that was? Yeah, go ahead, Jordan.
He signed the end of it with his own
hands. He signed them, but he signed them not by, you know, Apostle Paul. He didn't sign Apostle Paul. See, Paul had an eyesight problem. And we learned in Galatians that because of his eyesight problem, his handwriting was huge. You know, he was one of those guys when he wrote had to do this. You know what I'm talking about? And in order to see what he wrote, he had to write it pretty big, which is why he had, in most of his epistles, he had somebody else do the writing for him, and he would dictate, all right, and then they would write. And you'll see that at the end of most of his epistles, it'll say, that, you know, who the scribe was that actually did the writing for him. Yes, well.
And he also would end it with a very similar yeah. scene on each one in regards to grace be with you and all that.
Well, yeah, right. In fact, that's actually in, let's see. In look at the end of 2 Thessalonians. Just flip a couple pages to the end in my translation there. The last few verses, he says, now may the Master of peace himself give you peace through all in every way. The Master be with you all. Now notice verse 17, the salute with my own hand. And what that means is Paul, see, somebody else is doing all the writing for him in Greek, you know, in normal letters. And when it comes to the end, Paul puts his own salute, writing in his own handwriting, which was this big, goofy looking script because of his eyesight. And so it says, the salute with my own hand, Paul's, which is the token in every letter, this I write. And then verse 18 is what the Apostle Paul actually wrote. The grace of our Master Jesus Christ be with you all. Amen. See, he actually wrote the last verse in his own handwriting. All right. And it's always the same. If you look at all of his epistles, they always end with, may the grace of God or may the grace of Christ be with you all. Okay? You'll see it in every one of his epistles. And that was his sort of, you know, telling the congregations that if you get anything that doesn't have that in it, it's not from me. Okay? It's not from me. And it was because of this problem of false epistles circulating. All right. Let's get back to chapter 2. So he says that they shouldn't be all excited and move from their understanding by spirit or by message or a letter as if it was by us, to the effect that the day of Christ has become imminent. Now, you will find that last phrase translated differently depending on which translation you have. If you have an old King James Version, it says, is at hand. The day of Christ is at hand. If you have a new King James, it will say the day of Christ has arrived, or something to that effect. Some translations say the day of the Lord instead of the day of Christ. So there is different readings in the manuscript evidence. But one of the questions is about how to interpret this word that I translated has become imminent and that the King James Version translates as is at hand. There's a big difference between something has arrived and something is imminent. There's a big difference, isn't there? Something is about to arrive. Well, the problem is, the word that is used here in the Greek text literally means to stand beside and or to stand behind. It's like, Chase, come up here. Face them. Come up. Yeah, come up here. Face them. All right. Don't look at me. Okay. You don't know I'm here, right? I'm not here. I'm over here. Okay. And then just keep watching that way. Boo. Okay. Now, the question, you can sit down now. Thank you. The question is now, what did the metaphor mean to stand beside? It's a metaphor because literally the day isn't standing beside you. Okay. But what does it mean to stand beside? And there is some difference of opinion as to what that means. Some people say, well, it's here. But you have to understand that Paul uses this kind of metaphorical language prior to this. If you look back in, remember when we were looking at chapter 5 of 1 Thessalonians, and he talked about the unbelievers and how that they're going to be surprised by the coming of Christ. Remember that? Go back to chapter 5, verse 1 of 1 Thessalonians. He says, yet concerning the times and appointments, brothers, you have no need for me to write to you, for yourselves have observed that the day of the Master is coming like a thief in the night. For whenever they may say, peace and security, at that time utter destruction stands beside them unseen. And that's literally what the Greek says. And that statement is actually borrowed from Luke 21. We talked about that when I went over, when I preached on this passage. All right, that statement is borrowed directly out of Luke 21. So what he's saying is the wicked, they're saying peace and safety, peace and safety. And what's standing right beside them? Their utter destruction. Now, was their utter destruction present? Not yet. The point is, their utter destruction was right there, almost on top of them, threatening them that it's going to happen to them any minute now. You see, there's that sense of imminence. When Paul uses this statement about standing beside, the idea is that it's so close that you could almost reach out and touch it, but it's not quite there yet. All right? It's that close. And that's what he's saying here. And it's misunderstanding the metaphor that is the reason why some people or some translations have has arrived. And also the fact that he puts it in the perfect tense in this place. Now, what does perfect tense mean again? I've talked about it quite a few times, but if you don't remember, that's okay, because you're not required to learn any Greek grammar here. But it's helpful to know this, the perfect tense, because it's fairly rare, and when it does occur, there's a reason for it. Perfect tense means something has happened in the past, and the result of that is present now. It's still continued to the present. So if you look at this term the way I just described it, with Chase standing here, and I'm way over there somewhere, and he's oblivious to me, right? And I'm way over there, and then I sneak up behind him, and there I am. He's still not quite aware of my presence there, but I just arrived right beside him. Now, the perfect tense of this verb is describing that. All right? As though the day of the Lord or the day of Christ has just become imminent. That's what the perfect tense of that verb would mean, in using it in that metaphorical way. All right? So the King James translation is correct here, is what I'm saying. The King James translation is at hand is a phrase that means is imminent. It could happen any moment now, but it hasn't quite happened yet. All right? Literally, it should be has become at hand or has become imminent, to translate the perfect tense correctly. But anyway, I want you to get the idea. Paul is not saying, don't be all excited and worried because the day of the Lord has already happened. That's not the point. The point is, don't be all excited that the day of Christ is like almost on top of us. It's like so close you could reach out and touch it, all right? Or has become imminent. Now, there is a time. You remember when Jesus, in Matthew 24, when Jesus, the disciples said, Lord, what is the sign of your coming in the end of the age? And Jesus gave them a list of signs. And he said, all of these things have to happen, but the end is not yet. Isn't that right? And then he said, but when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, then flee to the mountains, because the stuff is going to happen, right? It's going to happen any moment now. Then, so what we see from what Jesus said is there's a lot of things that have to happen, and they don't mean that his coming is imminent. But when a certain event happens, then his coming becomes imminent. That is, it's very, very close, and it's going to happen, in a very short period of time. All right. So what he's saying, what Paul's saying here, is he didn't want the Thessalonians to become move from their sound understanding or become all excited that the day of Christ has come real close and it's all this stuff is about to happen. His return is almost here. So what does he say? I'm looking at the wrong. I'm still in 1 Thessalonians. Okay, so he says, none of you, verse 3, none of you should succumb to anyone's deception through any method. Now, he warns them about being deceived with regard to this, with regard to how close the coming of the Lord is. He warns them that. Did Jesus say anything like that to his disciples when they asked him about the signs of his coming? What verse, Walter? You're there, aren't you? Okay. I want to show you what he said in verses 3 and 4. Matthew 24. Now, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And what's the very first thing Jesus said? Take heed that no one deceives you. All right? Now, is there going to be deception about the timing of Christ's return? Yes. Why would that be? So you won't be ready. The deceiver, there is a deceiver, right? His name is Satan, doesn't want you to be prepared. And so there's going to be deception about his coming. And so he says, don't let anyone deceive you. And the Apostle Paul here, in answering the very same things Jesus answered, starts with the very same thing. Right? What does he say? None of you should succumb to anyone's deception through any method. Because, now notice this, should not the apostasy come first and the revealing of the man of sin? Now, this is actually a question in the Greek. Unfortunately, most of our translations, they put it into a statement as opposed to a question. And in doing so, it requires them adding some extra words that are not in the original language. It essentially says the same thing. But technically, this is a question. All right? It's an interrogative. So he's saying, shouldn't something happen first? Shouldn't two things happen first? That's what he's saying. Now, if he's asking them, then they should already know. Isn't that right? Do you guys agree with that?
Yes.
Instead of saying, oh, well, let me tell you something. See, some other stuff has to happen first. But that's not what he said. He said, don't let anybody deceive you. Shouldn't these two things happen first? This apostasy and this man of sin be revealed? Shouldn't that be first? And why would he say that? Because, again, the background information for what he's talking about comes out of Matthew chapter 24. And what did Jesus say about all this? I mean, they're well familiar with what Jesus wrote. So what did Jesus say? Well, let's look at what he said about apostasy and what he said about the man of sin. He told the disciples back in verse 6 that they're going to hear about wars and rumors of wars, not to be agitated or troubled or excited. For all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. That is, these are not the sign of my coming. They're going to all happen, but that doesn't mean my coming is imminent. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Then they will deliver you to tribulation. They will kill you. You will be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended. Now notice this. Many will be offended. Now, when he says many, who is he referring to? He doesn't say many what? What class of people does many refer to in verse 10?
Christians.
Why?
He's addressing his apostles. He's addressing the many here. He's talking about they're going to deliver you and kill you.
The word you. You see the word you in the previous verse? The word you is referring to Christians, to believers. And when he says they're going to deliver you and kill you, he's talking about his own followers. And then he says, and many, meaning many of you, okay? Many of you will be offended and betray one another and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many, that is, many of you. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold, that is, the love of many of you will grow cold. Now, the word love there is the word agape, the term for love that refers to God's love or the love that reflects from the heart of a Christian back to God or back to his fellow man. It's not normally used of normal human love. It's a special kind of love. It's the love of God, right? That self-sacrificial kind of love is the term that's used, though. It's clearly talking about Christ's followers when he says, you. All right. So the love of many or the many of you will grow cold, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. Now, Luke's gospel says many will fall away. It uses the actual term many will fall away when it's talking about the very same thing. Now, what's the best word to describe Christians who begin to hate one another and betray one another? And are deceived by false prophets, and because of lawlessness, their love grows cold.
Apostasy.
What does the word apostasy mean?
Turn away from something.
You know, it's from two Greek words, apa, which means away from, and stasis, which means to stand. To stand away from something. That is, here's Christ. You know, we are Christ's. We're with Christ, and we do. I love the way the Greek language uses metaphor. It uses these literal terms, but you have to understand the concept and you apply it in more of a metaphorical way. It's a very colorful language, by the way. Yes?
And the word apostasion, which word it comes from, is to divorce from your faith.
The neuter form No, it's the other way around. The neuter form, I believe, is apostasy, and the feminine form means divorce. But they're from the same root. All right, this is the same. It just changed the inflection on the end. You get a apostasion and apostasia. One's neuter, one's feminine. One means divorce. The other one means to separate yourself from God. Okay, or what is good and what is holy. So, but the point is, he says, Paul's saying, now look, the question about us being gathered together to Christ at his coming, and the question about whether this is imminent, whether it has come very close now, or whether it has not come very close now, Paul resolves that by saying, look, shouldn't the apostasy come first? And shouldn't the man of sin be revealed first? And he's asking them that because those are the two major things that Jesus said were going to precede his coming. Because remember, prior to that, he said, oh yeah, there's going to be wars and famines and pestilences and all that. But all those things have to happen first, but that's not the sign of the end. But then he says that there's this apostasy where his own people are going to turn away from the faith because of false prophets, because of persecution, because sin, lawlessness is going to abound, and because their love for each other is going to grow cold. And you know what's really sad about all this? Is that word many there? The love of many will grow cold. The word many, I mean, you can interpret it a couple of ways, but it really means the larger part.
There's a definite article before, but it's not English.
I don't know if the definite article is there. I don't have a Greek in front of me.
It
could be. But which would mean the larger portion. The love of the larger portion will grow cold. But then he says, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. That is, the one who is not deceived by the false prophets. The one who does not succumb to the lawlessness. The one who does not is not deceived begin to hate his brother and betray his brother. Or the one, when persecution comes, doesn't say, I didn't sign up for this, you know. That kind of thing, right? The ones who stick with him to the end will be saved, is what he says. So what he's saying, essentially, what Jesus is teaching in this passage is that the bulk of those who profess to be Christians, what appears to be Christianity on the surface, that ultimately, when the poo hits the fan, for lack of a better term, the size of Christianity is going to go from this down to this. All right, it's like, you know, when you turn the lights on and the roaches. That's what a lot of Christians are going to do when the persecution comes. Oh, I'm running out of here and go hide someplace. You know, not that it's wrong to look for cover, but I mean, depart from Christ because it brings persecution in those times. So that's what the apostasy is. But what does Jesus say immediately after that in Matthew 24? 15, he says, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, that is the temple of God, whoever reads, let him understand, that is whoever reads Daniel, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains and so forth. And he talks about this brief time of great tribulation. If you were to look at Daniel, he refers you to Daniel. If you were to look at Daniel, Daniel tells us how long it's going to be, 3.5 years. It's in Daniel chapter 12. All right, tells us from the time of the abomination of desolation until Christ returns and the inheritance is given is 3.5 years. So what Paul is doing in this passage when he says, look, don't be alarmed that Christ's coming has become imminent, because shouldn't two things happen first? And when he asks it in a question form, he's wanting them to think back to what Jesus taught, right? And Jesus said there's going to be an apostasy of his own people in mass turning away from the faith, and this man of sin is going to be revealed. All right, and Daniel tells us all about what he's going to do. Well, Paul goes on to describe what he's going to do as well. So let's look at that in 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 3. He says, Yeah, none of you should succumb to anyone's deception through any method, because should not the apostasy come first, and the revealing of the man of sin, the son of destruction, the one opposing and self-exalting himself, exalting above every named god or worshiped thing, so also as a god to appoint himself into the temple of God, portraying himself that he is God? Now that's all a question. I know it's really long, but it's a really long question. But he's saying, shouldn't this happen? And he goes on to describe it within the question. So this man of sin is going to go into God's temple. He's going to defile God's temple. He is going to claim to be God in the flesh and defile God's temple. So what Paul is saying here is, look, the arrival of Christ and our being caught up and gathered together to him, he points them back to Jesus. Don't be excited that it's going to happen any moment now, because look what has to come first. Look what Jesus taught has to come first. All this in Matthew 24 has to come first. All right, that's the point. And then when you get down to the end of, towards the end of Matthew 24, well, actually verse 29 through 31, we have it, him describing how he's going to return and blow the trumpet and gather his elect and all that, which is 3.5 years after that. All right, so let's, excuse me, let's continue. Yes. Yes.
He talks about the apostasy. It seems as if he's talking about a very specific event almost. Or would you say that it's more of a period of time of this defection from the faith that's going to occur? It almost weighs that the apostasy is like this major event that's going to occur.
Yeah, and he puts it before the man of sin appears.
Before that.
Yeah.
So something happening where Christians are going to really start, because the mark of the beast really doesn't get forced upon or try to be forced upon people until...
After the man of sin is revealed, yes. Spence?
No,
go right ahead. Yeah.
I know that the second largest religion in the world, Islam, has a prophecy about Christ appearing. And they actually prophesied that Christians and Jews are going to turn and follow this false... Mm-hmm. Christ, the Esau, and then he's in their prophecy. He's going to turn around and surrender all his authority to the Mahdi.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a theory out there that this is one of the deceptions that are going to be.
Yeah, but keep in mind also that there may be deception in Islamic eschatology as well.
Right.
So that doesn't necessarily mean that that's how it's going to play out. But I think I think there's a lot. I think that's something that we need to keep in mind, because in my opinion, how it's all going to play out is there's going to be sort of a conglomerate religion where Islam plays a part, apostate Christianity plays a part, apostate Judaism plays a part, where it's all going to come under a single umbrella of a sort of a world religion that is going to try to suck Christians in as well, and I think will suck a lot of Christians. But that's just my opinion, okay? I don't want to preach that as how it's going to play out. That's just kind of me looking down the road as to how things might probably will play out. But anyway, we'll see how it plays out, okay? But hey, you cannot deny that there's a great apostasy even now going on. There are many Christians who are turning away from the faith even now. Okay, so, but apparently this is going to be a significant enough event that Paul is holding it up as a sign. So if he says two things have to happen first, the great apostasy and then the man of sin, and these are the two signs that you'll know that Christ's coming now, you can say his coming is imminent, all right? After that happens, then it has to be something that can be recognized as an event, just like the man of sin, you know, entering the temple can be recognized as an event. So I would say it's probably something quite significant that we're going to see in the very last days, a mass exodus from people holding the true faith and embracing a false gospel that doesn't save anybody. Okay, so we'll leave it at that. We'll see how it plays out. All right. So he says, let's pick it up in verse 5. Do you not remember that while being with you, I told you these things? And now you have perceived that which restrains, that which is holding back this man of sin being revealed, so forth. You have perceived that which restrains in order to reveal him at the appointed time. Now, you know what's funny about this is you know, the Apostle Paul, he says, don't you remember that while I was with you, I told you about these things? But he doesn't tell us what he told them. You know, we have what he wrote to them in 1 Thessalonians, and we have what he wrote here. But he spent a lot of time, we spent some time there, and he was explaining all this stuff to them, and we don't have the benefit of his oral teaching that he did. And obviously he covered that, because he says, you know, when I was with you, I told you about these things. So he obviously covered that. And unfortunately, he says, he doesn't tell us who or what that restraining thing or person is in this text. He just says, you already know it, because I already taught it to you. But unfortunately, he didn't tell us. All right. So there's different opinions about what that is. My opinion is, if you look at what Jesus said, referring when he's talking about the abomination of desolation, he says, standing in the, written by Daniel the prophet. And then he says, whoever reads, let him understand. That is, whoever reads Daniel, let him understand. So to me, the answer to these things is in Daniel. Okay, the book of Daniel. Reading the book of Daniel. In light of what Jesus taught, and in light of maybe Revelation, and in light of all the revelation that's come after it, and here we are in the end times, or close to the end times, and what we know, how things have played out. When we go back and read the book of Daniel, we really should be able to find some of these answers in the book of Daniel. And I think this answer is in the book of Daniel. Who is the one who is restraining the revealing of the man of sin? Why isn't Satan able to produce this master, evil tyrant all down through history? Why hasn't he been able to produce that and, you know, have that play out? And it's because God has set a timetable for it, and he has a restrainer holding back Satan and his plan to do this until the proper time, right? Yeah.
There's been several times where, like, Michael had to hold back the prince of Persia.
Yeah, in fact, that's where we're going. So, yes. Yeah. So let's look at that. It's in, keep your finger in Matthew, but go back to Daniel chapter 10. In Revelation and in Daniel, more so in Revelation, but in Daniel, you know, Daniel has all these visions and dreams, and he sees world kingdoms and stuff portrayed as beasts and things like that. But what Daniel is primarily seeing is the world stage in how the various kingdoms and kings are going to play out in history, right? We saw that started with Nebuchadnezzar's image, you know, the gold head and all that. It has all the world history there just in that one thing. And he sees all this happening and how the physical players on the earth are going to play out. But in Daniel 10, it's sort of like God pulls the curtain back just a little bit and gives Daniel a little bit of glimpse into the spiritual realm that's behind all of this. Because there are angels, there are demons. You guys know that, right? And angels and demons are influencing things on the earth. We don't see them, but we see the effects of what they do and how certain kingdoms rise and fall and things of that nature. And God uses his angels to restrain the demons that are trying to bring so much havoc on the earth by means of earthly powers and earthly kingdoms and earthly weapons. Because, see, demons don't have, you know, 50-millimeter guns. And they don't have tanks, and they don't have bombs. Right? But governments and nations do. And the primary weapon of Satan and his demons is deception. And he can get into people's minds and cause them to do very evil and wicked things with all the inventions and weapons that have been created. Right? Isn't that right? That's how things have played out. Well, in Daniel chapter 10, Daniel gets a little peek at what's going on behind the scenes. That is, you know, who's really behind some of the players that are going on. And he says in Daniel 10:1, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar. The message was true, and the appointed time was long. And he understood the message and had understanding of the vision. These days I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks, and I ate no pleasant bread, nor meat, nor wine came to my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all till 3 whole weeks were fulfilled. He was fasting and praying for 3 weeks, 21 days. Now, on the 24th day of the first month, as I was by the side of the great river, that is the Tigris, and actually Spencer's been there. He's, when he was in Iraq fighting, he's been there, the Tigris and the Euphrates, right? I'm probably got your feet wet in one of those, right? No? All right. I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man clothed with linen, whose waist was girded with the gold of Ephah's. His body was like beryl, his face like the appearance of lightning, and so forth. I'm going to skip all this. This is an angel appearing to Daniel. But I want to show you what the angel said to him. Verse 12. But he said to me, "Do not fear, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand, that is at the beginning of his three-week fast, and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard." Hey, God heard you the first time. That's what he's saying. He fasted and prayed 21 days. But he said, hey, God heard you on the first day. All right. "And I have come because of your words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. Now, the prince of the kingdom of Persia is not a human being. It's a demonic entity. There was not a human prince that was withstanding this angel or keeping this angel from coming to Daniel. All right? Because human beings cannot restrain angels. But a demonic power, a very powerful demonic power, had interfered with the communication between God and Daniel by means of this angel by delaying him for 21 days. That's quite a delay, wouldn't you say? But look what he says. "And behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left alone there with the kings of Persia. And now I have come to make you understand what will happen to your people in the latter times," and so forth. Now, later on, after he talks about the message that he had to deliver, you get on to verse 20, he says, Then he said, "Do you know why I have come to you? And now I must return and fight with the prince of Persia." That is the one who was he had trouble with the first time. He's going to go back and do some battle there somehow. "And when I have gone forth, indeed, the prince of Greece will come." That is, and if you look at the visions Daniel had, the prophecy of the various kingdoms was that the Persians would come and overthrow the Babylonians, who were in power at that time. And then after them, the Greeks would overthrow the Persians. And so these empires that were to go in one in succession after the other, there was some kind of a demonic power, which he calls the prince of Persia, the one that was influencing the Persian kingdom, and the prince of Greece was the one influencing the Greek kingdom. And what we see in the book of Revelation is that we see these monsters coming out with seven heads and all that kind of stuff. These are some of these demonic entities being portrayed in a graphic way. They don't literally have that, but they're being portrayed that way in a symbolic way. So there's these demonic entities behind the scenes. Now, when you get down to, I closed my place there. When you get down to I wanted to read to you the next verse. I should have read that. Verse 21. "But I will tell you what is noted in the scripture of truth." Now look at what it says next. "No one upholds me against these except Michael, your prince." Michael, the chief, and he's called the archangel, which means the chief angel in Jude. And he's saying Michael is the one who came to my defense when this demonic power was, preventing me from coming to you. Michael is the guy who came and took care of business so that I could come and deliver the message. That's what he's saying. All right. So Michael was the one who made that possible. Then we get to chapter 12 of Daniel. It says, "At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. And at that time, your people shall be delivered. Everyone is found written in the book." Now, what he's saying is Michael's going to stand up. And the word stand up literally means, to get up from a crouching position. But it could be like, how wrestlers are. You can pin somebody down and you can restrain them by pinning them down. And here he says Michael is going to stand up or stand aside. And there's going to be a time of trouble. The implication of that is that Michael has been interfering with that for a period of time, and when he stands up, then the time of trouble happens. All right. Now, that makes perfect sense to me, that Paul, when he's talking about the one who is withholding, would be Michael. Because, again, Paul is constantly referencing Matthew 24. And in Matthew 24, Jesus was talking about Daniel, that this stuff is in the book of Daniel. All right. So you see the connection there, I guess. I mean, there's some inferences, but yes. We're talking about world empires and stuff, and we're pretty insignificant compared to that. I don't know if any, you know, demons are going to be concerned about us in that regard. So I don't know the answer to your question. You know, you're taking it from this grand scale and bringing it down to a level of an individual person like us. We're pretty insignificant in God's plan compared to Daniel and him writing the scriptures. So I don't know the answer to that. Okay, that's the bottom line, yeah. That's right.
World.
Yes.
And when Christ returns, he's destroying this amount of power, mm-hmm. and out.
Yeah.
Whereas his angels are like, you know, struggling. And
yeah.
He's just saying they'll be gone.
Yeah. Well, Paul says in what is it, Ephesians or Galatians, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers and all that stuff. So but now we do it primarily through prayer. All right.
I wonder if Daniel would have given up. If he would have prayed and not fasted.
I don't know, but I think there was a reason why God allowed that delay to take place. All right, I think that was part of God's plan as well, to allow that. God allows demons to do certain things. He kind of keeps them on a leash, right? They can do a certain amount. It's kind of like a wild dog that you have on a chain. You know, he lets them do what they do up to a point, but there's a point where he draws a line and he won't let them go any farther. All right, so... ultimately, God is going to be in control there. But there is some freedom, you know, within certain limits. Yeah, exactly. That's an excellent example of that. God kept, you know, he allowed Satan to beat up on Job, but he put a limit on it. Okay, you can do this, but you can't pass this point. And the demon couldn't pass that point. And Michael and his angels are there in the spirit realm as law enforcement, you know, basically, they're the police, and the demons are the criminals, and they're trying to keep law and order. And of course, ultimately, God is not going to let things get totally out of hand. All right, that's as far as I can go with that. All right, without making too many leaps of logic there. All right, let's pick it up in. I want to try to finish these few verses here. Now, verse 6 of 2 Thessalonians 2, and now you have perceived that which restrains, in order to reveal him at his appointed time. For the mystery of lawlessness is already acting. Only one is now restraining until he should go out from between. And this phrase, go out from between, means that he's sort of intervening between two opposing powers and keeping things at bay, basically. Verse 8, and then, that is when this one restraining moves out of the way, then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the master will consume by the breath of his mouth and shall destroy by the manifestation of his arrival. Now, I have that in brackets. You may notice in verse 8 where it starts, whom the master will consume. You see that? I have that in brackets all the way down to by the manifestation of his arrival. It's in brackets. And the reason I put that in brackets is it's a parenthetical statement. Because if you don't do that, then the next statement says whose arrival is in accord with the energy of Satan. Then it would, if you don't put it bracketed, then it's implying that Christ's arrival is according to the energy of Satan. And that's clearly not the case. That's not what he's saying. All right. So it's sort of a bracketed statement just telling us about what's going to happen to him. But then it says, whose arrival, that is the man of sin, is in accord with the energy of Satan, with all power and signs and false miracles. Now, this is what Jesus warned about, isn't it? Look back at Matthew chapter 24. Don't Don't worry, I'm going to wrap this up soon. I know I'm going over time. Matthew chapter 24, verse 24. For false Christs will and false prophets will rise, and notice this, and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. How are they going to deceive? You know, Jesus said, take heed that no one deceives you. And he said, many false prophets are going to come. He says, they are going to show signs and wonders to deceive even the elect. Signs and wonders. That is fake miracles. Or, let's say, miracles that are by the power of Satan and not by the power of God. But the intent is to deceive you into thinking that they are miracles by the power of God. That is false manifestations of the Holy Spirit, false prophecies, right? Hey, you know what's amazing to me? I mean, the Bible talks about this, all the signs and wonders that took place during the times of Christ and the apostles. You know, the speaking in tongues and the prophecies and the gifts of healing and all the stuff that was present in the early church. And now, here we are talking about the very last days. It talks about false signs, false prophecies, false wonders, false miracles. That are, the intent is to deceive. Did you know that the Bible in the New Testament only talks about the true signs, miraculous signs like this, in association with Pentecost and the early church? And it only speaks about false lying signs in relation to the end times. It never mentions anything about these kinds of things occurring, the true signs like we saw at Pentecost, occurring in the end times. Whenever it talks about the end times and signs and wonders, it always refers to them as false and lying signs and wonders. You know, that's something to keep in mind. That doesn't mean that everything that might happen now cannot be of God. But what it means is we should be extraordinarily careful and cautious when dealing with those kinds of things, because Jesus has warned us, the Apostle Paul warned us, that this is how the apostasy and the man of sin is going to come in, is by deceiving even the elect, Christians, deceiving them by the use of lying signs and wonders. So keep your guard up. Don't believe everything you hear. Okay? That's all I'll say about that. All right. Verse 10, with every deception of injustice among those being destroyed because they rejected the love of the truth for their deliverance. And through this, God will dispatch a fraudulent energy for them to believe the lie. Wow. So that all those having disbelieved the truth but having delighted in injustice should be condemned. Now, in some way, and I'm not going to try to speculate at this time, exactly what God is going to do that is going to facilitate all this happening. I have a theory, but I don't want to say it from the pulpit. But God is going to do something that is going to facilitate this great deception and the accepting of the Antichrist as who he claims to be, God. He's going to do that. And why is he going to do it? He tells us why he's going to do it. So that they may be condemned, the ones who refuse. See, he says he's going to do it because they refuse the truth. And so if they refuse his truth, he says he's going to do something that's going to cause them to believe a lie. Instead, in other words, if you won't accept the truth, then here, how about this instead? Yes.
You have to do with like the beast being killed and come back to life, people may believe
in life. I think so.
Oh, yes. He's the risen Christ.
Yes. Yeah, I think it does have to do with that. Because that seems to be the kind of a miracle that Satan can't possibly do. So, but I don't want to say definitively that that's the case, okay? But there is something very amazing that's going to happen that is going to lead people to accept the Antichrist as, you know, as the Messiah and cause Christians to turn away from the faith. And God is going to provide the power for that to happen. But he's only going to do it so that those who are already, whose hearts are already rejecting him, and they have already rejected his truth, that they will grab that and accept that in its place. And he's going to do it in order to condemn them. Because what it's going to do is it's going to manifest what's really in their hearts already. See, it's going to reveal what they really are, as opposed to, it doesn't cause them to do anything, because they're going to have to choose. You know, people are going to take the mark of the beast because they choose to take the mark of the beast, right? Nobody's going to force it on somebody, or God's not going to hold anybody accountable if they're forced, you know, it's put on them while they're tied down. You know, that's not going to happen. People are going to take the mark of the beast because they willingly make that choice, but they are going to make that choice because they have already rejected the truth of God and the truth of his word. And by taking the mark, it seals their condemnation. God says, you know, that's the final straw right there. All right. So anyway, let me just read the last verse there. Verse 12, so that all those having disbelieved the truth, that is, they notice having disbelieved is perfect tense. Isn't that interesting? See, they already disbelieved the truth. And perfect tense, what does that mean? Something has happened in the past, but it continues to the present. The result continues to the present. So their disbelief, they have rejected it, and their disbelief continues to the present. Because of that, then God sends them the lie, or facilitates the lie to come so that they'll embrace that in its place. But it's because they have already rejected the truth. And that's the thing you have to keep in mind. It's not that God is making people do evil and then punishing them for it. It's because they've already rejected what is good that he says, okay, well, here, have this instead. And they'll accept that. And then he will judge them. And that's perfectly just. All right? All those having disbelieved the truth, but having delighted in injustice, they should be condemned. That's why God does it. Does that make sense? All right. This is some serious stuff. This is some stuff that should bring fear into our hearts, especially when we look at the passage that that Paul was referencing from Jesus, and how he talked about how so many of his own followers are going to abandon the faith and be condemned in the end. And I don't want to be one of them. And you don't either. But it's going to take some perseverance when the bad stuff really starts coming. And it's going to come. It's going to get increasingly worse. All right, but it's going to get really bad towards the end.